You are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with RAFA, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004. Today, we're in Bagnères de Luchon.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And it's great to be joined again by Andy Hood of Velo News.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure. First time since American Independence Day, Andy. We've got you here on non-American Independence Day.
That's true. Getting close to Spain, which is my kind of European base. Looking forward to not having to rush to dinner tonight.
Well, where are we, Lionel?
We're at the Racing Club Luchon Rugby Club, looking out on the glorious pelouse. The pitch looks in good nick, doesn't it? Rugby posts are up. A little sort of non-league football club style grandstand on one side of the pitch. Lots of cars parked around the pitch, and then flanked by the mountains, the Pyrenees. It's glorious here.
Rugby,
it's lovely.
Rugby's huge down here, isn't it? The southwest of France. And any idea why that is?
Because they really like it.
Okay.
There has to be a reason.
I keep meaning to look into that properly because it's amazing. Anyway, we've got lots to talk about in today's stage, and I think you've got the tail of the attack.
I have, A very busy day today, so I'll try and keep it as brief as I can. Stage 8 from Pau to Bagnères de Luchon. Before the race got underway, a little bit of news to update people on that. Probably everybody knows Adam Yates was given the white jersey overnight after the incident with the 1 kilometre to go inflatable banner collapsing on him and sending him flying. Yates turned up this morning sporting a few stitches in his chin and the white jersey, and he was visited by the tour boss Christian Prudhomme, who apologised for the incident, basically complimented Yates on dealing with it in such a sort of elegant and calm way rather than making a big unseemly fuss. And Yates said that he really appreciated Prudhomme's apology, even though obviously it wasn't Prudhomme's fault directly. We've subsequently learned what ASO are saying happened. Somebody apparently walked past a generator which was generating the power that was pumping the air into the inflatable banner, and the cable or the whatever it was caught on the person's belt buckle and pulled out. I mean, that's the line they gave us this morning. The explanation
Sounds
of what happened.
Lionel.
I'm not sceptical. It's just what an absolute one. It's not just a freak occurrence. This is now one in a million chance.
But the timing of it as well.
Exactly.
Was extraordinary. Extraordinary.
Incredible. I mean, you know, we don't want to get too grassy knoll about it, but you know, maybe
was there a grassy knoll?
I don't know. I wasn't down there. Anyway, to today's stage, 184 kilometres in the Pyrenees, over the Tourmalet, the Orquette d'Ansisan, Val Luron Azay, and the Perisord. Early in the stage, there was a classy break of three that got away. Rafa Majka, King of the Mountains a couple of years ago. Tony Martin, probably the best ruler in the peloton. And Thibaut Pinot, the slightly bruised Frenchman. They were well up the road. Well, Greg Van Avermaet was quite soon slipping out of the yellow jersey on the Orquette. Pinot and Martin were reeled in with 43 kilometres to go. Majka was caught a few minutes later, but managed to hang on to the group pretty well. Pinot then slipped out of what remained of the peloton. Somebody on Twitter described it as like a knob of butter on a frying pan. He slipped through the group like a knob of butter on a hot frying pan.
More, when you were describing it as bruise, I was thinking of a peach in a supermarket. It's just been squeezed a bit too much.
Yeah.
And That's what I think of when having a table pinot. It's like a bruised peach.
Indeed. On the Perisord, which was the final climb, there were a few jabs, but no serious blows. But the one thing to note was that Sky always had a numerical advantage of at least a couple of riders over the likes of Movistar, Astana and Tinkoff. Towards the top of the climb, there was a few riders losing contact. Warren Barguil of Giant Alpecin started to struggle. And when Sky's Sergio Henao lifted the pace, more riders began to lose contact. Among them, Wilco Kelderman, Geraint Thomas, Pierre Hollande, and then Alberto Contador. It's probably the biggest name to lose contact. Over the top, Chris Froome accelerated and kept on going all the way down the other side. We'll talk about this later in the episode and whether this was a pre.
I think we'll mention it.
We may well mention this, yeah. Because he'd gone for King of the Mountains points on the previous climb, and then when he went for the summit of the Perisord, everybody just watched him. Anyway, it turned out to be a move that won the stage and took the yellow jersey, gave it everything on the descent. That's the third British stage win in a row after Cav and Cummings. Dan Martin of Etix Quickstep led the group in 13 seconds later. So the damage then, Barguil and Contador lost 141 to Froome. Rolland and Kelderman lost a little bit more. Rolland particularly unlucky because he had a slow puncture on the towards the top of the climb, didn't realise, and the wheel just slipped from under him on the descent. What else? Pino lost 16 minutes, Alaphilippe and Nibali over 25, and we finally had the first abandon of the tour. Unfortunate for Michael Merku, the Katusha rider from Denmark. It's been on the cards for a few days. Yesterday he was talking up his chances.
The pronunciation of his name.
I know, and he is the first of the 198 riders out. So Chris Froome in yellow by 16 seconds from Dan Martin and Joaquin Rodriguez. Mark Cavendish in green, Rafał Majka in polka dots, and Adam Yates in white. Tomorrow is the final stage before the rest day and the first summit finish at Andorra Arcalis.
So Sam Bennett, the Lantern Rouge, someone we've been speaking to a lot, but yeah, you were quite impressed with Chris Froome's attack there, Andy, weren't you?
Yeah, it was impressive. It actually reminded me a little bit about what Quintana did to Uran at the Giro 2 years ago. Over the top of the Stelvio, there was different situation, but taking advantage of a key moment in the race proved decisive in the Giro when Nairo attacked Uran and ended up winning the pink jersey. And Nairo at the finish line was kind of admitting that he made a mistake, let his guard down there. And Froome, really just absolutely impressive. I mean, I think we have three or four finishing downhills this tour. I mean, Sky obviously had that planned, even though they say they didn't.
Well, yeah, that's an interesting one. I mean, we'll hear from Dave Brailsford. We've got an interview with him, exclusive interview with him, because he's not really been speaking to anybody. So I use the word exclusive advisedly there. We've got George Bennett, who had a little interest. And we'll hear from Dan Martin in the last part as well, who lives in Andorra, where we're heading tomorrow. And he was a key man today, and he actually looked very impressive. But Froome, I mean, there was that issue, you mentioned it, Lionel, of him sprinting for King of the Mountains points at the top of the previous summit, which provoked a sort of flurry of disapproval on Twitter and other places, which I found really odd. I mean, I think you're entitled to sprint for King of the Mountains points. What's potentially good about it is that, you know, if it's to gain points in the King of the Mountains competition, it means he's taking it seriously. And I think for many years it's been a second-rate competition, so he won it last year. Maybe he's serious about it, though there could be another explanation. While Poles was actually first across the line, maybe he's trying to help him win it. Who knows? But it arguably did help him over the Paris-Tours when he went again for the points, apparently, and then just carried on. At that point, and you mentioned the numerical advantage that Sky had, I was quite surprised on that climb that Quintana was down to just two teammates, Yoni Izagirre. And they were doing an odd thing of sending Izagirre to the front from time to time, and he would be riding really hard, whereas Sky were riding tempo. And I wondered if that was some kind of ploy. The only other guy there was Valverde. Now, Valverde would have been a good guy to close the gap to Froome in that situation, and didn't, and Quintana didn't either. And I had a chat at the finish with Nico Portal, the sports director at Team Sky, who was really interesting on how difficult it is to descend when you're not right behind somebody. As soon as the gap opens a bit, you're not following them around corners, you're not seeing what line they're taking, you know, being able to judge your speed and braking and so on from the guy in front of you. So as soon as you've got that gap on the descent, it can be quite an advantage. And Froome did get the gap, and nobody closed it. But Andy, did you think you heard from Quintana at the finish? Any idea why they didn't close it down?
Yeah, he said that they kind of let their guard down momentarily. They thought, everyone assumed that. We talked to BMC and other teams, were just assuming they would bring him back. There were 13 guys chasing whatever it was. And they said finally Valverde started to chase, but by then it was just too late. Froome, I think once again, there's this notion out there that he's somehow this bad descender. He's never been a bad descender. He doesn't look good on the bike. Everyone kind of agrees with that.
Doesn't look good uphill either.
Well, I don't want to mock because descending like that is an incredible skill. And the risks he took, the position he assumed was extreme, sitting on the top tube and carrying on pedaling. I mean, we have seen that.
Your line's coming off. You shared with me while we're watching it.
Yeah, he did look like a frog on a skateboard, didn't he? I mean, that, unfortunately, it wasn't elegant, but who cares? I mean, yeah, they won't care about that. They got the job done. My only question is, was the effort required worth the time gain? I guess in terms of laying down a marker, in terms of reminding everyone there's three more of these kind of finishes to come, and just getting into the yellow jersey this early in the race, I suppose it has to be seen in those terms, but, you know, would the guys in the group behind have been saving a fair bit of energy on that descent? And I mean, it's a difficult one, isn't it? Because you go from climbing small gear on the way up, and then you've got to change pace and then push a big gear. And I think I saw Hoodie, your colleague Kayleigh Fritz, said that Froome had a 54 tooth chainring, which on a descent like that, I mean, that's to enable him to keep his cadence pretty high and really ring as much as possible out on the descent.
Yeah, you have to also wonder if Froome and Sky are coming into this mindset of this first part of this tour really to take control of the yellow jersey before they even go into the Alps, because tomorrow we've got to have Arcalis, big showdown between Nairo and Chris, and then Vontu and the time trial coming up early mid-next week. You just have to think that their strategy is get time on Quintana, get time on everybody else, take control of the yellow jersey, and then just carry it all the way through the Alps.
I think he does need that buffer of time. I think that's a factor. I think even if that move wasn't planned, I think when he saw he had the gap, he's mindful of the fact that I've said he needs 2 minutes on Quintana going to the final week, maybe a minute and a half. But in the two tours he's won, he's lost around about a minute and a half to Quintana in the final week. He was ill last year, so that's a factor. Shall we hear from Dave Brailsford? I spoke to Dave Brailsford at the finish. He's not been doing a lot of media this year at all, which is unlike him, and he was avoiding camera crews and so on. But I met him walking back to the team bus. He was with Tim Kerrison, and we just sneaked behind a tree and did this interview. What were you saying earlier? Was that a plan, or you said you didn't see that coming?
No, did you see it coming? Well, I don't think anybody else saw it coming, and I think, you know, when we were at Dauphiné this year, we decided to maybe change the way we rode, and you know, I think people thought pretty predictable and ride in a certain way, which you know we have. It's been very effective, and that's why we're ridden in that way. But given the riders that we've now got in the team, you know, I think it's always there were always opportunities to change that around a little bit. And I think one of the things here has been nobody's taken control. You know, no one team, none of the GC teams anyway, other of the rivals have stepped up and gone right, will contribute to the chase and everything. So I thought, you know, we just thought, right, okay, we're here to win, you know, and somebody's going to step forward and say, all right, I'm up for this fight, and we are, and so we took it on, and in the end, there was always the option with the likes of Sergio and the other guys that, you know, could try and make something happen. And I think it was more to start with, obviously, about agitating the situation and an element of surprise, really. Because I think when we were in tempo like we had all day, then I don't think anybody expected any of us to attack, you know. So that was good, you know, like that. And then obviously fair play to Chris in terms of capitalising on the opportunity and taking it on like he did. You know, that's.
There were some people wondering about, he sprinted for the King of the Mountains points at the previous climb. With Wout Poels, I think Poels was first across the line, Chris was second, Rafał Majka was third. A lot of chat about whether what he was doing there, and a theory maybe a bit far-fetched that it set up the next climb where he sprinted also for the line and then just carried on. But is King of the Mountains is something he won last year? I mean, is it something that's important to him, or do you have any insight into that?
When your team's taking it on and all our team's riding, the whole team's committed, and another team just sit there and pop up at the end and expect to get a free ride, then they've got another thing coming, you know. It's just, that's not the way it works. You know, if you want to compete for things, you want to get out there. Fair play to Mike, he got himself in a break, etc. But, you know, I think if you take the race by the scruff of the neck, then I think you're well entitled to expect to have a certain reward from that.
So Chris Froome is the new cannibal, the new badger.
I think he's always been that, to be fair. You know, he's a terrific guy, and he's, in terms of his mentality as a rider and how he races, you know, I think, again, he's shown a different side to his repertoire, which nobody saw come in, let's face it. Nobody expected that. And I think the element of surprise is something that, when people do say you're predictable and all the rest of it, then why not use it?
Is descending it's an area of the sport that's been neglected over the years and seems to have assumed more importance the last few years, but is it something Froome's worked on in particular?
Well, I think certainly, you know, I think we've been quite heavily criticised in the past for descending, and, you know, and people say that it's a limitation of ours. But we've looked quite carefully, done quite a lot of studies on our tyres and our setup and our wheel setup. And we kind of looked at the grip, rolling resistance, and the best tyres for the best tyres at the best pressure for the best courses. for the best, for the right rider, should I put it that way. And also, I think, you know, there's options now where people more and more are looking at different wheel combinations, front and rear. And so that comes into it as well. So you get your setup right. And hang on to your hats, I guess.
All right. I think you don't have a wheel sponsored, do you? So
Yeah. So we ride Shimano wheels. And I must say their overall kind of wheel setup has improved and changed dramatically over the last, I'd say, 4 or 5 years. Whilst we've been in the sport, they've done a terrific job. And they've got some new wheels coming out now that which are fantastic, you know. So their range of wheels is now right up there. And of course, then you've got the different weights of wheels. You know, there's quite a big difference in terms of all the weights of the wheels on the market. And certainly the Shimano's now are getting very competitive. So you look at all of that setup and you study it, you know, and you see where, you know, it's a bit of a boring thing now, but where are you going to get your gains from?
You almost said it there, Dave.
No, I caught myself just at the right minute then. There's no chance, yeah. Yeah, although we've got a laundry truck, you know, so we've tried to improve how we wash, how we clean all the, you know, because you think the ride is everyday infection. So we bought a trailer full of specific washing machines and dryers so we can individually wash each rider's kit. Yeah, just go to town on the whole washing things. And on the side of this trailer thing, we've got a couple of hashtags, obviously, like, you know, ride clean, da da da. And then I see that marginal stain was on there as one of the
someone from the team put that.
Yeah. Not very funny, I think, Fran Miller.
Quite funny.
Yeah.
So that was Dave Brailsford. Very interesting. My question about, I didn't think they had a wheel sponsor. I thought Team Sky used their own wheels. One of the reasons for thinking that is that Elia Viviani in the World Championships last year used a special set of wheels, but maybe because he was running for Italy, he was able to do that. But, you know, they've clearly been putting a bit of thought into descending, you know, in terms of the equipment they use and so on. And that is an area of the sport that has been neglected.
Yeah, I think a lot of people mock the marginal gains idea or sort of try to say that the Sky aren't doing anything. That it's PR and marketing, yeah, then the Sky aren't doing anything that the other teams aren't doing. And to a great degree, that's true. But we have seen Grand Tours decided on descents, and that's one area of weakness that Sky have had. I'm not saying Froome's a bad descender, but they've never exploited descents. And you know, interesting listening to Dave Brailsford there, everybody thinks they know what to expect from Team Sky. Control, several riders on the front, same pace all the way up the climb, burn people off one by one from behind, launch the big attack with Chris Froome, and they're already showing signs that they might be doing it differently.
What's your impression, Andy, as somebody, you know, you're particularly tuned into Spanish teams? I think Movistar have really been very progressive in the last few years. They've openly kind of copied Team Sky's approach to sports science and so on. But, you know, what's your impression as a sort of outsider? Because we've followed Team Sky closely from the beginning, obviously. The whole marginal gains thing, is it your opinion, or do you think that Sky do still have that margin over other teams, and that they are consistently sort of changing? We see everybody warming down now after stages. That's something that Sky started in 2011, you know, and there have been little innovations. They're all little innovations that people tend to copy. Is it your impression that they're still a little bit ahead?
It seems like that they're... remember last year, coming into last season, they kind of had to hit the reset button, and they said, we can't get lackadaisical. We have to keep challenging ourselves and setting new goals and try to do things in a different way to keep that edge. I think the other teams are clearly copying what Sky has done. Every team now has trainers, physios, the chefs, the skin suits, the aero bikes, everything that they've done. Other teams have emulated, including Movistar. They've really, you know, Movistar was kind of the old school team back in the Indurain days. It was just old style, kind of classic European bike racing. And that team has really modernized itself, I'd say, over like the last 5 years with Movistar sponsor coming on. And they've kind of expanded their coaching staff. They have people that work specifically with the different riders. You know, back in the day, it was just the sport director who used to kind of handle the coaching for all the guys. But you still get the sense that Sky kind of does have that edge, whether it comes through some of their technology they use in their training programs. You know, you just kind of get a sense sometimes that other teams are still kind of a half pedal behind.
What's that? What's that sound?
Yeah,
Evening, chaps. I'm coming to you live from the, or as live, from the Zone Technique about an hour and a half after the finish. Everyone's packing up here in Luchon. Very eventful day in the end, or certainly very eventful last half hour. We thought we were going to see the classic Sky Catenaccio. And then we got the Parasword, and the Parasword is always conducive to attacking. It's not particularly steep. We saw, I remember, a classic duel there with all the usual caveats between Michael Rasmussen and Alberto Contador in 2007. Loads of attacks that day. There were plenty today as well, but the coup de grace really came from Chris Froome on descent and took everyone by surprise. A very experimental, almost sort of surrealist, cubist, I don't know what it was, descending technique, which I christened the food processor or the smoothie maker. I'm sure that's not going to catch on. However, something truly novel. It probably won't have delighted those who already object to Froome on aesthetic grounds. And it also won't have delighted those who wanted a closer race this year, a closer race throughout the 3 weeks and not just on the final mountain stage, as we had last year at Alpe d'Huez. A few shards, glimmers of hope if you don't want Sky to win the Tour de France. One is that they've obviously been stung by the criticism of their robotic modus operandi, and they've obviously wanted to change things, and Dave Brailsford was certainly very pleased with himself at the finish today. He was kind of rubbing his hands as if to say that Sky and Froome had confounded their doubters by doing something that was very unexpected. However, is that desire to prove people wrong, will that lead them into error later in the race? That's a possibility. We also saw them experimenting with counter-attacks today, which is something that they, or a counter-attacking style that they haven't used that much in the past, with Sergio Henao on the Parasword. Second sort of asterisk by Froome's performance today. I've spoken at length about this before on the podcast, about how there is a trend with general classification riders just past their 30th birthday, 31, 32, where they cease to be able to cause the same damage that they once did in the mountains going uphill, and the more inventive ones turn their focus to descending. And this happened with Eddie Merckx in the last years of his career. It's happened with other riders as well. Could it be that Chris Froome saw fit or wanted to attack on the descent today because he's not terribly confident of dropping people going up? That's one hypothesis. I think it's probably not the case. However, that's something to cling to for those, like I said, who don't want Team Sky to win. Elsewhere, another bad day for Thibaut Pinot. He's definitively out of contention now. I thought yesterday that it might be a mental issue. We've spoken before on the podcast about how Thibaut, when he's on particularly good form and when he's put an awful lot of preparation into a race, he tends to freeze slightly, and that's happened before at the Tour de France. And the better the form he's in, the more likely he is to get the heebie-jeebies and freeze slightly. I thought that might have been the case today. His ride today, he went down the road and was in a breakaway and it didn't stick, and he lost 16 minutes in the end. That ride suggests that it is a problem of condition and it's not a mental issue, but I'm sure he'll find his legs between now and the Alps. I'm hoping to find Lionel and Rich one of these days. Got a few fleeting glimpses over the last couple of days, but I'm sure we'll catch up, chaps, maybe on the rest day in Andorra. In the meantime, it's good night from me, and have a good journey, chaps, because I know ours is going to be very long trying to get into Spain over the Portillon. Well, we're not going to be going over the Portillon because it's been closed, so we might have to dig a tunnel into Spain.
Eurosport, the home of cycling.
And now, Pedaleur du Charme.
Thank you very much indeed to Eurosport for sponsoring Pedaleur du Charme. Every day we present Pedaleur du Charme t-shirt. We didn't even try with Greg Van Avermaet this morning. He won Pedaleur du Charme yesterday, but he's in the yellow jersey. He's not in the yellow jersey anymore, so we will give him a t-shirt soon. I'm sure that'll be more than adequate compensation for losing the yellow jersey. Quite a few nominations today. A lot of nominations for Chris Froome. Now, that sticks in the craw a little bit for a lot of people, because when you think of Pedaleur du Charme, you don't automatically think Chris Froome. I mean, as good a bike rider as he is, he's not elegant. And I think a lot of the antipathy, the even hostility towards Froome, stems from how he looks on a bike. I really do think there's a lot of snobbishness, actually, towards him for that reason. Froome was nominated by lots of people for... He was handed a bottle of water from a roadside fan. He doused himself in it to cool down. He then handed it to Alejandro Valverde, which was a very sporting thing to do. So he got a lot of nominations for that. Then a lot of those nominations were retracted when a kilometre or so later he punched a Colombian fan in the face. The Colombian fan was running alongside him holding a flag and very close to his handlebars. It is really dangerous. And Brian Cookson the other day was saying, don't run alongside the riders. If you're in the mountains watching the race, don't run alongside the riders. Mm-hmm. Someone's going to get knocked out. You're going to influence the race and not in a way that you want to influence the race. So please don't do it. And Froome said that as well. If you run alongside the riders, you deserve whatever you get, frankly.
It's almost become like the running of the bulls in the San Fermines in Pamplona.
Yeah,
where people up there drinking all day, getting drunk, and they're just waiting for the guys to come by, and it's a recipe for disaster. I mean, it happened that one year, Guarini in Altuez back in the day. Mm. It's going to happen again.
That was a photographer, wasn't it? Crouching in the road, looking through his viewfinder, not realizing he was as close as he actually was. It's amazing it doesn't happen more often. We do see incidents, so people shouldn't really do that. Froome then also completely disqualified himself from Pedal de Charme for his frog on a skateboard descent. Also, he's in the yellow jersey. Maybe we'll give him a Pedal de Charme t-shirt before the end of the race, but he's going to have to really work for it. Mm. He's going to have to work harder than most riders for it.
So, yeah, George Bennett, Kiwi riding for Team Lotto NL Jumbo. He had a very big day out, so let's hear from him.
Well, I guess you saw everything there is that's involved in being a domestique in the mountains today. Talk me through what happened.
I had a few jobs today. One of them was getting in the breakaway, which was pretty difficult, you know, because it didn't go for about... Well, it never really went, did it? I mean, I tried a few times at the start, and then I tried a few more times before the Tourmalet, and then I just did one full effort. Yeah, you know, I got away with four guys, but it was like Alaphilippe and it was just stupid, you know? We were riding full gas, Pinot. I mean, it was never going to work, and I really cooked myself up there, so I suffered all the way up the Tourmalet. Today, it really was my first time. It was really my turn to do my thing, and I'm happy it went well, and I'm happy I'm in good form, and I'm happy there's a lot of mountains still ahead, so I can hopefully... Well, I don't know. I've got to look at the situation with what Wilco is and what he's lost or what he gained and see if they'll let me off the chain to go on the breakaway or I'll be stuck in, I mean, either way, I'm happy.
Forgive me if I've got this wrong, but did you have to give up your wheel for him as well?
Yeah. That's actually how he crashed. We had very small climbing wheels on, and the problem with that is they don't dissipate any heat. And it was just so hot out there that I don't know if this is true, but for what it looked like, I mean, I've just arrived, so I might be completely wrong, but it looked like the glue, it had melted, you know, and the tyre had rolled, and he just essentially just got shit-whipped into the ground head first. So I ripped my wheel out, burnt my hands in the process. It was so hot, you know, really blistered. I got blisters on my fingers now. And pulled my wheel out, put it in his bike, but then, I don't know, I didn't look at the rest of the bike. He ended up getting a new bike. And then by the time I tried to get my wheel back on my bike, my spare bike was standing there ready to go. So, yeah, in the end, I should have just kept riding and let him come back with the cars. But
I guess, lastly, hard to keep you cool in the heat of battle. I mean, you mentioned the weather being hot, but the race was really on at that point as well.
Yeah, that was not the moment to crash. Out of all the moments in the day, that was one of the worst.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast. In association with Rafa. Whoever you are, wherever you ride, whatever the reason, Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories, and vibrant clubhouses and communities all over the world. See rafa.cc for more information.
Thank you very much indeed to Rafa for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. I've mentioned it a few times, but they are also covering the Tour de France on their website, rafa.cc, or if you look on Twitter, hashtag more than a race. Today is a piece about the Col du Tourmalet, which the riders went up. It covers some famous feats on the Tourmalet by riders with colourful nicknames, from the Eagle of Toledo to the Watchmaker of Avila. Is that right, Andy? Avila? Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Avila.
Avila. The Watchmaker of Avila. The Bricklayer of Friuli. Friuli?
Friuli.
Friuli.
The Bricklayer of Friuli. The Iron Man of Tuscany. The Hobgoblin of the of the Brittany Moor, my favourite one.
And the Lion of the Chilterns.
The Lion of the Chilterns is here, and the Buffalo of, I don't know,
The Buffalo of Edinburgh.
Buffalo of the Borough.
The Buffalo of the Borough.
Andy, do you have a nickname?
I've been called many things, but can't really put it out for public consumption.
Eurohoodie, you are on
Euro
Twitter,
Hoodie
of course.
Is kind of my
at Eurohoodie,
one,
yeah. We're going to hear from Dan Martin in a moment or two. I thought he looked very good today. I mean, let's go through some of the riders who we perhaps expected a little bit more of. I mean, Thibaut Pinot staged a bit of a fight back after his bad day and day one in the Pyrenees. He was on the attack, but as you said, Lionel, ended up losing a lot of time. Warren Barguil, I expected a little bit more from him, but he came in that Contador group, a minute 41 down. Geraint Thomas, I think we weren't too surprised to see him be tailed off. He's struggling with his rib injury, and he's not quite, I don't think, in the form that he was in last year. Pierre Rolland had that incident with the wall. And there was a split on the climb on the Perisord, and it sort of came back together, didn't it? And for a moment or two, Romain Bardet, Adam Yates were distanced. Balcom Mollema was always up there, I think. TJ Van Garderen was always up there. And Romain Bardet then attacked. Dan Martin was always up there. Martin and Bardet both attacked, which I wondered if they might regret if... If Froome or Quintana had countered, and they might struggle. But I have a sense, I have a feeling that Martin, who was second on the stage, Dan Martin, is in extremely good form. He's also extremely skinny.
He really is. I mean, and he looks confident, and he was kind of kicking himself a little bit at the finish, maybe, that he didn't react. He talked a little bit about the sort of negative style of racing in the Tour de France, not just this Tour de France, but the Tour de France. There's a kind of sense of fear. There's always a sense of fear, isn't there, that if you overextend on one particular day, it will come back and bite you twice as hard on another day. And so it's always about calculating and judging the risk. But, you know, he was willing to stretch his legs a little bit towards the top of the Perisord, and then he led in the group over the line and got a few seconds in a time bonus. And really, when you look at the overall classification, there's now 13 riders within 34 seconds of Chris Froome, and then the 14th man on the list, Warren Barguil, is at 151. So whilst Barguil and Roland and Kelderman and Vandenbroek and Port and Contador are not necessarily out of contention, they're looking like they would be the sort of riders that would feel the, you know, might move up to the bottom half of the top 10. Yeah, when you look at the top places overall, it's all the quiet men that kind of that you notice when you look at the results, really. The people you perhaps haven't seen so much of on the road, Joaquim Rodriguez of Katusha, Fabio Aru is in there, TJ Van Garderen has sort of kept himself very calm, very quiet, riding, you know, that sort of perfect opening week of a Grand Tour. And so that group of riders, there'll be another little sort out at Andorra tomorrow, and then a few days lull before Mont Ventoux. So it's starting to take shape, isn't
Aru,
it?
Aru looks surprisingly good. Anyone catch your eye, Andy?
Well, I was around the Tinkoff bus, talked to Alberto, well, in the media scrum. It wasn't like a one-on-one chat, was it? it never is at the Tour de France, is it? But Alberto is kind of waving the white flag. He was said even yesterday already that Kreuziger has the green light to race. There was that little stink up the other day in terms of Kreuziger didn't wait for Alberto. I mean, personally, I thought in that situation that Roman did the right thing. I mean, Contador was already among the walking wounded at that point of the race, and it was pretty clear he wasn't going to be coming back. And it's almost, you know, really we can say this is almost the end of the Contador era, I think, because Alberto, 33, next year, rumor has he's racing for Trek, but really, can he come back and win another Tour de France? I personally don't think so.
No. Well, listen, you spoke to Dan Martin, didn't you, Lionel? Let's hear from Dan Martin.
Can you estimate how much effort Chris Froome would have made over you guys in the group behind? And can you put a value on whether that effort was worth it for those seconds gained?
I don't think so. I mean, it's obviously he tried harder than us sitting in the wheels, but then, he obviously gained time. And I mean, gaining what 20 seconds ish with a time bonus, you have to try really, really hard to gain that on a climb on anybody, so it's or in a time trial. So but that's racing, you know. It's very it's tactics, you know, and Chris was the day and wanted to do it.
Talking of tactics, people were surprised that Froome had gone for the King of the Mountains earlier on. Maybe it was a bit of a double bluff, so that when he went for it again, nobody thought he was making a stage-winning yellow jersey-taking move.
You might be right, actually, because I saw him going. I thought he was going for the King of the Mountains points first, strange. Then he just kept going over the top, and it was. Yeah, maybe that's what the other guys are thinking as well. But this is my environment, though, you know, in the Pyrenees, I love it. So, yeah, and the first week, it's still. I mean, I've always been showing well in 1 week races, so this is still my what I'm good at. So, still need to prove myself in that last week, you know. But we'll see. Tomorrow's on home roads as well. I think we passed 600 meters from my house. Obviously, I know the climb really well, and ordinarily, it's not the most decisive climb. It's not the most difficult climb in the race. But I think with the impact and the fatigue that's been brought on by the last week's 8 days racing and how difficult the stage is as a whole tomorrow, and with this heat as well, I mean, it's even hotter in Andorra at the moment. Well, it's definitely going to take a toll on guys who haven't recovered properly. I know the roads really, really well, and it's nice to be going back to the base where I call home.
So he's more or less on home roads tomorrow. Dan Martin lives down here, knows the Pyrenees incredibly well, knows Andorra very well. Interesting comment about the climb to Arcalis. It's a bit of a main road, isn't it? Do you know the climb well?
Yeah, it's one of these just endless grinding climbs. You go up to one of the ski stations there in Andorra. Of course, that's where Ulrich kind of cemented his victory in the 97 Tour. Just one of those classic, long, hard grinding climbs. Perfect, really perfect for Froome, isn't it?
Yeah, and, you know, I commented earlier, or not in the podcast, but we were chatting earlier, that in both of the tours that Froome has won, he's won the first mountain stage, and he's won again today, not in the way, the style that we've expected, but he does tend to put down a marker on the first big uphill finish, and that's what we've got tomorrow. And, you know, I think we're expecting quite big things. I mean, everybody will get excited. You know, Froome attacks and goes off alone, everyone will get excited and say, oh, the tour's over and blah blah blah, but I stick to my pre-race prediction that he needs 2 minutes on Quintana going into the final week, and I think that's what makes this year's race really interesting. Quintana will be, for all that he's lost 13 seconds on Froome today, I think Quintana will be absolutely delighted. This time last year he was a minute and a half down, having lost it in the crosswinds. He'll be delighted. His team will be absolutely cock-a-hoop.
Well, you hope they can turn the page, because at the finish line today they were not happy in the Movistar bus.
The team is a concern, isn't it?
Yeah, and plus the team's been kind of riding erratically. We saw yesterday Froome and Valverde sharing a few words coming across the line. I think those two teams were having some difficulty even yesterday and today trying to figure out who was going to do the workload just to control these breakaways, especially yesterday when that break got so much time, that Sky wanted to see more work from
Movistar. Well, that's what Brailsford was saying, yeah, that no team is taking control. And when you've got the yellow jersey, then it becomes your responsibility to take control. That will make things slightly easier for Movistar, who might rally. The question is, does Quintana need a really strong team?
Well, that's the argument that I think the whole theory was. You know, just get Quintana to the Alps, to the mountains, on equal time to Froome, and Quintana can outclimb him. But actually, when you think about it, yeah, late in these tours, Froome's been on the back foot sometimes. He's lost time to Quintana, but he's also had that cushion to play with. You know, really, could he have gone with Quintana in those previous two tours if he really had to? I think he could have. I've never actually seen Quintana outclimb Froome one-on-one when everything was in play. Yeah, he dropped him last year at Alpe d'Huez, but how much time did Froome have? He had 2.5
Semnoz,
minutes.
He sort of took a bit of time out of him, didn't he?
Yeah, but the tour was wrapped at that point as well, I think. So we'll see. I mean, I would love to see an arrow in this tour, but I think Froome impressed me again today. I mean, he's almost like Merckx when he's at the finish, when he races. He races to win. And people criticize him for his style and for being kind of a bot, like a robot, like that Sky just has these formulas and they run through the computers and there's no passion. But there's a lot of passion in the way Chris Froome races.
I think that's unfair with Froome. I mean, I think the challenge they've had at times is curtailing his racing instinct, reining him in a bit, because he wants to attack a lot. And I think that his attacking instincts almost cost him the tour in 2013, and maybe that's an exaggeration, but he seems to be doing too much at silly moments. And I that thought crossed my mind today when I saw him taking off from the descent. As Lionel said, I wasn't sure if the bang was worth the buck. You know, he put in quite a big effort, but I think at the back of his mind is this idea that he has to put some time in the bank for the final week. Should we wrap things up? We're going to have lots to talk about. Andy's going to be joining us again on other days, we hope. So, but thank you very much for tonight, Andy.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.